call the meeting to order. Welcome to the Thursday, May 12, 2011 meeting of the AMAC Citizens Involvement Committee. Certainly welcome all the people who haven't had a chance to come to CIC before, and welcome back everybody as been part of the committee right along. Don't be deceived by the formal agenda. We have a lot of territory to cover tonight. So what I'm going to ask is we go ahead right to item 2, which are the minutes of the Thursday, March 17, 2011 meeting. Came in your packet. And if I could, I'll ask you to please take a moment to look it over if you haven't had a chance, and we'll accept motions for the minutes. Okay.
And second.
Okay, we have a motion from Ms. Swindell and a second from Mr. Mackey to accept the minutes of the Thursday, March 17, 2011 meeting as submitted. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of accepting the minutes of the March 17th meeting as submitted, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. We'll now move to item 3, which is the technical progress report, and Jason will provide us with some additional information there.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Good evening. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Jason Segedy. I'm the director of AMATS, and wanted to just go through a couple things in what we call our technical progress report, which is basically what our staff has been up to for the last couple months. And some of this stuff is on the agenda, too, so I won't belabor some of those items. But for those of you that are familiar with some of the things that AMATS does, one of the big things is we have a traffic counting program where we go out in the summer and count approximately 200 different locations all throughout our area to look at traffic volumes, and we do that to assess traffic congestion. We also do that to when we do analyses of traffic accidents, the amount of vehicles that pass a given point is an important variable for calculating a crash rate. So that program's underway. At our technical committee meeting, we did tell all of the members of AMATS today to let us know of locations that they're interested in having counted. I would say even from a CIC perspective, if there are locations that you have concerns about with either traffic crashes or congestion, please talk to myself or another member of the staff, and we could probably look either at counting those, or if they've been counted recently, get you some information on traffic crashes or the level of traffic congestion, because I know those are both obviously big public concerns. We've been doing a lot lately with bike planning and pedestrian planning, and Krista's going to talk a little later in the agenda about some recent public meetings we had for cyclists, and basically the goal of why we're having these meetings is to produce a new bike plan for the region. So we'll give you some more information on that in her presentation. We've got a new transportation improvement program, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later, what that is and what that means for the region. One thing that AMATS does, we allocate around $20 million every year in federal transportation funds to local governments throughout Summit and Portage County. And this fall, we're getting ready to do another round of funding applications. Typically, we get for $20 million. Well, when we go out for funding in one given round, we usually fund about $30 million worth of projects. We usually get $150 to $200 million worth of applications, so we have to prioritize. Like anything else, there's a lot more needs out there than there is funding available, so we prioritize those. But we will be doing that in the fall. So if you have suggestions on transportation problems or anything like that that you would like to see a project to address, when I present that item later on the agenda, please don't hesitate to let me know, and we can give you some information how you can work with local officials in your community to have them put an application in for funding. One thing that we've talked about, and Mike, I can go into as little or as much detail about this as you want if we have a discussion about it, but the last couple of meetings we've talked about the federal transportation legislation or the lack thereof. There's not really anything to report on that. There's you know, they're in Congress, they're having a lot of discussions, as you've probably all seen on the news, about the debt ceiling and lots of other issues. So transportation has kind of taken a back seat. Having said that, I mean, the transportation funds continue to flow. There's not a, we're just kind of under continuing resolutions for the same level of funding.
You might want to just take a moment and for the folks who are new to CIC, if I understand what is being done is that an overall, what they call an omnibus bill, right, is being pushed down the road by Congress. And maybe you want to comment.
Right, I mean, just a little bit of background. Every 6 years, Congress passes a transportation bill. The last bill expired in October of 2009. And so for the last year and a half, we've been getting close to 2 years now, we've been under these continuing resolutions where Congress continues to provide the same level of transportation funding. It affects our agency because, like I said earlier, we directly serve as a conduit for federal funds. Much more affected even by it would be an agency like ODOT, who, you know, most of the federal funds that come to Ohio come through the state. And basically what they're arguing about in Congress right now is a lot of people want to see the transportation, the funding for transportation go up. I mean, obviously, as a transportation planning agency, we would like to see that too, but there are very real issues of where, like everything else in Washington being discussed, where does that money come from? And we talked before about raising the gas tax. That is probably less popular than ever. I just paid, I think, $49 to fill up my tank. So, but the issue is still, where will that money come from? And no one really has an answer to that question yet. So we're kind of at the same level of funding for transportation. And it's probably actually good these financial problems are going on, in the sense that I think it's going to make Congress have, eventually when they talk about a new bill, have a fairly candid discussion about what are our national transportation priorities. I think I've given my opinion before at these meetings that we're still doing kind of a schizophrenic mix of policies in Washington, where there's all this money being spent on high-speed rail, but the same policies are going toward improving the freeway system, and it's like we just don't have enough money to spend a lot of money on every single mode of transportation. So I think there's some priority changes that need to be discussed if we're going to continue to fund things the same way. So I hope that wasn't too much detail.
No, I think it was a good summation. I appreciate it. Does anybody have any questions? Anything? Alex?
Let me make a comment. I thought it was interesting the last week or so when the some people said it was a trial balloon, the idea of a mileage tax was put out there. I don't know how many of you have heard that in the news, but when it makes the local 6 o'clock news, it sort of filters down. And we've talked about that like a year ago or so. We were discussing that as an option. So for me, it was like, well, gee, that's not new information. But for other people that have never heard about that, the idea that instead of paying, or maybe in addition to paying gas tax for the gasoline you buy at the pump, which is what, about 23 cents or something like that, can you say?
18 cents federal taxes and 26 cents state tax.
Oh, okay, so it'd be higher. In taxes that you would be paying a tax for the miles you drive, because cars are more efficient now, using less gas, and so less money's going to the fund. And I think the reaction to that was pretty negative. From every place I've heard, every story about it was not real favorable, even though that was one of the solutions. And then the administration kind of backed away from that and said, oh, no, we weren't really thinking about that. But it was just with a memo that got out there somewhere, we were kicking the idea around.
Yeah, I think like we discussed when that came up on the gas tax discussion, I mean, personal opinion is that would be probably an administrative nightmare to try to collect that tax. You know, it would either entail taking your car into a station and having the odometer read, or putting black boxes in people's cars, which would probably be an even less popular idea, or some sort of self-reporting, which would be prone to fraud and things like that. So, yeah, you're right. I think that trial balloon kind of sunk back.
Well, they are doing a trial in a voluntary trial in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that they're asking people if they want to volunteer.
And I think they've done some in Oregon in the past, too.
Okay, anybody have anything else to add? All right. If not, we'll move ahead to staff presentation, item number four, public bike meeting summary, and Krista will give us some additional information on that.
Hi, thanks. I think we brought up, we are doing a lot of work with promoting bicycling in the region. I think we shared a bike users map that we were working on at the last CIC meeting, which sort of ranked roads between easy, medium, hard. As part of that whole bike initiative, we've had two public bike meetings over the past month. We had one at Highland Square in Akron and one at Kent. And they both went really well. The one in Highland Square, we had about 22 people, and the one at Kent, we had over 30, and a lot of really good discussion. At each of those, we just did a short presentation, and then we had it essentially open to get feedback. We had the room sort of divided into on-road and off-road, and we got a lot of good comments on, you know, what people are, what the needs are, what the challenges are. The three main things that we were trying to get at were we asked people, you know, like, where are you riding and how do you get there? You know, basic questions. Is it recreation? Are you riding commuting? How far? Where are you trying to get? What can we do to improve our roads and experience? And then, you know, how can we better promote biking in the region? And we had a lot of people that were, you know, really excited that this was being promoted. Had great ideas. They were excited that we were doing something about it. Our Switching Gears is what we are labeling our new bike initiative, and we will soon, hopefully in the next couple months, have a website, and that'll be everything from getting feedback to our plans and projects, and then also creating a community resource for bikes, you know, whether that's a blog or, you know, posting all the rides and events and working with the local bike shops to do promotions. We're also working on Bike Week is next week. And if you notice, there's water bottles in the back, so please take one and feel free to grab that and promote it. But that has our new logo, and we're also doing with Bike Week a commuter challenge for the city of Akron where we're giving out free things for, depending on if how much you ride, if we can get who rides the most into work, and we're logging miles for people. So we have, you know, things like gift certificates to the bike shops, free tune-ups, and that sort of thing. So we've had a pretty good response and people signing up. And just some of the basic things that we got from the meetings, a lot of people interested in advocacy, how we can do that. Education and safety always come up. You know, sort of the same barriers as far as debris in the roads, snow removal, you know, people, just general driver education about biking. So, in general, the meetings went really well and people were really excited. So our next steps are kind of taking all the feedback, trying to build this site, participate in Bike Week, and go from there. So if you have any questions or any ideas on, you know, biking in general and what you'd like to see, we'd love to hear it. But that's about it for that.
Okay, yeah. Mr. Laudermill?
Yeah. What percentage of the budget from your organization goes towards bike paths and things like that? Is there a set percentage, or
from a construction for actually building the bike paths and
buying gift certificates, building bike
paths? We didn't buy any. We actually those were donated by the bike shops. From our construction budget, we spend approximately $1.5 to $2 million every 4 years on bike infrastructure. Sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. But percentage-wise, it would be around, I would say, 8% of our funding.
Okay.
And that's also counting. You know, usually most of our funding has gone into things like the towpath, so kind of a dual pedestrian and bicycle use.
And you're responsible for maintaining the towpath area?
And no.
Just
no.
The structure?
Yes. And actually one of the AMAT's policy committee, which is all the mayors and local officials in Summit and Portage County, which has decided on those funding policies, they typically have set up our policy so we don't maintain the bike trails. We'll give the money for the initial construction, but then it's the responsibility of the municipality they're located in, or a lot of them are located, like, for example, the bike and hike trail is part of Metro Parks. The towpath, a lot of it's in the Cuyahoga Valley National Park, so those entities, assume the maintenance responsibility.
The bike trails and those things, is that being driven as a primarily a recreational outlet, or is this an attempt to lessen the traffic on the roads by cars? Or
I think the trails have definitely been, I think, overwhelmingly a recreational type facility. I think a lot of the, like Krista mentioned at our meetings, we kind of had an on-road and an off-road component. The on-road component, we get a lot more interest from cyclists that actually do commute or, you know, use the roadways for non-recreational purposes. Our agency really hasn't done much in the way of bike lane projects or anything. Most of the funding has gone into the recreational trails, and that's one reason that we wanted to do this initiative and kind of recalibrate and see, especially now that the towpath is almost complete. You know, there you get to a point where it may not make sense to keep spending that level of money on recreational trails and either spend less on cycling infrastructure altogether or kind of rechannel it into improving roads.
Just out of curiosity, the meetings that you had, do you have any idea what percentage of the cyclists, or the people using, I assume it would be mostly the on-road lanes, are actually using them for recreation or using them to commute?
I don't know if we really got a real good feel.
I don't know as far as kind of, and I would still say there's, you know, a lot of people are really using the recreational trails, especially, you know, I mean, anyone, families, and that sort of thing. There's definitely like a pretty solid group of, you know, your more avid cyclists that, you know, will ride in the road that have no problem. But I think that number is still, you know, like the minority, you know, that there's like a small group of people that will ride anywhere and are comfortable. But I mean, for the most part, I think people either are doing it recreational or there's a lot of interest in commuting, but you keep hearing just not feeling comfortable in the roads due to whatever traffic speeds or just, you know, kind of the education of the motorists.
Yeah, I'd say to answer your, probably I would guess half and half probably was the percentage, but we didn't have a very representative sample with, you know, 25 or 30 people at each meeting.
But by far, as a general rule, it's a very small percentage actually using to commute.
I think if you took all the people that ride on the towpath and combine them with all the people riding on the road, yeah, they're, I think the recreational travelers outweigh the, although we are seeing more and more, in fact, one thing we're going to try to do this summer is some, I mentioned our traffic counts for cars. We're going to try to do some traffic counts for bikes because just anecdotally, and I think even observing some of the traffic patterns with gas prices going up, I think obviously for a lot of people it is not feasible or they don't have any interest in riding on the road, but for I think some people that can substitute driving for short trips, we've seen a little bit of an uptick anecdotally in cycling.
There are quite a few people too that even if their main purpose was recreational, like they would really like to see trails from their neighborhood to, you know, like say the towpath or the parks or, you know, to those amenities. So they would maybe, you know, ride on the street for a little while, or if they had more of like a bike lane or a path, they could use that. So, I mean, that was one of the big things, is connections from, you know, the trails or the parks to the neighborhoods.
Yeah, that was a big comment. People that didn't necessarily want to have to drive, you know, put their bike on a bike rack and drive down to the towpath, they would prefer to have a safer network of roads to be able to ride to it.
I want to sort of summarize what we had at the last meeting. I was asking, we have a north of Hudson on 91, there's a marked bike path. We use the term sharrows with an arrow and a bike silhouette on there to alert drive vehicle drivers. Bikes have the right of way. Well, yeah, just as much right as a vehicle. And my other comment was maybe we could mark side roads. Maybe a bad example, Main Street down through Akron, you may not feel safe, but if you went over to a side road that was marked with signs or sharrows, this would be the parallel bike path to commute towards or get around in Akron. I'd like to see that maybe just followed up in the reports. You know, we have the recreational people who are on the parks, but people who want to commute or go about and do business, if we can't mark sharrows on a road, maybe we could have, and this might go into the construction area for a designated bike path in urban areas, signs with the sharrows on them to keep the drivers aware that this is a primary bike route, even if you can't give them that word of a 6-foot lane or something like that on the side of the road. Maybe we could pursue that in the future for enhancing bike movement within the city.
Thank you, Mr. Mackey.
If I one real quick thing, Bill, on your, I think that's a good comment. Your comment about the parallel routes, we're starting to kind of get into that a little bit, where we got on our website a draft of a what we're calling our bike users map that we have put together, where we're trying to evaluate the, and this is fairly subjective, but evaluate the bike ability of given roads, you know, whether they're kind of beginner level, like most people would feel fairly comfortable, to kind of a, this is a pretty difficult road to bike on. You know, kind of the difference between maybe Chestnut Avenue in Cuyahoga Falls, Chestnut Boulevard in Cuyahoga Falls, versus riding on Route 18 at Montrose or something like that. And but part of that is we're doing that so we can maybe start to identify parallel routes. And when we go to do a bike plan, if we make any recommendations about a need for lanes or wider shoulders, or like, for example, there were a lot of cyclists that didn't necessarily want bike lanes constructed. They would prefer to just have a wider shoulder. But then there were a lot of, like Krista got at, that there are a lot of issues people don't necessarily think of at first blush, like with a lot of shoulders, if the municipality doesn't keep up with keeping the road swept, then all the debris and broken glass and tree limbs and stuff go into the shoulder. So sometimes a wide shoulder, you know, just becomes like a catchment area for all the debris of a road. But we are thinking about the parallel lines.
I have a question, because we saw that bike map before you had your public meetings. Did the attendees at the two meetings, were they aware of the number of paths available to them at both meetings, or was it a surprise, or did they already know us?
I think they were real aware of the paths that were out there. I think what they weren't quite as aware of is plans for, especially like at the Kent meeting, there were a lot of people aware of the portage, but they weren't necessarily aware of the, which I don't blame them, this is not necessarily common knowledge, but they weren't necessarily aware of the timing for completing the rest of the portage through Kent. So there are sections of the portage that I think they kind of assumed would never be built are actually already planned and funded, and it's just a matter of them actually being constructed. But I think there were also suggestions for connections out there that weren't really on our radar or the city of Kent's radar or anybody else's. So we got some real good feedback, I think.
Could we send that bike map gratis? I mean, it's on the web, or send notices to all, let's say, bicycle shops in the county saying you should make your customers aware of this map or something like that. You know, we're sort of advertising EMATs and the bike maps and the routes and the connections that they want to get around.
That's what we've been trying to do that pretty well. We had actually a really good turnout from a lot of the bike shops came to the meetings. Quite a few of them, I gave them a stack of maps, and they were really thrilled about like any information we have that they would set out and you know, help promote and put out. So at least I think 4 or 5 of the bike shops like have maps there for the draft, or of that draft user's map, and you know, anything in the future as far as getting feedback, they have been really helpful and good to work with. So I mean, I think that's one really good connection that we've made.
And strategically, like what we've been asking them for right now is more input on the map. Does this look right? You know, are we rating these roads appropriately? And when we have a little bit more feedback on that, then we may formalize that map a little bit more. I think right now we're not as confident as we want to be that that map is accurately showing all that. So before we actually publish it and make it official and say give it to cyclists as a resource, we want to, because like right now we're taking the position a lot of the cyclists know a lot more about the condition of those roads than we do, so that's what we're trying to get feedback on.
Okay. Nobody has anything else?
So the maps hard copy, or are they smartphone downloadable?
There's PDFs right now.
It's on. It's a PDF on our website, which is amatsplanning.org, and we also have it overlaid on Google Maps where you can zoom in and zoom out. That is quite big, so it takes a little while. But if you want a hard copy, we could, okay. But yeah, the website's probably the best way. But yeah, it's a PDF, and then you can also pull it up on Google.
If you have trouble getting it on a smartphone or anything, let us know. We can talk to our web people, too.
Okay, Alex?
Yeah, it sounds like you had some good turnout at the meetings, and one of the things that we talked about over a year ago was that was one of our first outreaches is to try to find bike people. Were you able to get a list of who these people are, and what kind of follow-up are you going to have with them, or how do you use them, and how do they use you?
I mean, I think we did. I mean, yeah, that was part of it. We have, you know, got everyone's, you know, names, email, contact. Do you want more information? You know, a lot of this was just, you know, kind of initial feedback, you know, put out what we're doing and get their input and just, you know, the introduction. So I think we've got a pretty good list. As far as next steps, you know, we talked about doing a survey at the meeting, and we sort of decided later, like, you know, once we've got, you know, a good group of contacts, which I think we've established pretty well, we can, you know, send out surveys, next steps, and especially when we start to do the plan, get input, and we already have a pretty good contact list of, you know, people that are interested that would want to give feedback.
How do you see that working with this group?
That's a good question. I mean, I think I'm glad you mentioned what you did about how we had that discussion, because it did, I don't know if it kind of just through osmosis, so I think a lot of those ideas ended up informing the way that we did these meetings and the outreach. And I think in the future, really depending on the level to which everybody on CIC would be interested or want to get involved, I mean, we could do a special CIC meeting, you know, devoted to cycling. We could invite everyone to a CIC meeting where that would be highlighted, or I mean, if individual CIC members especially were interested in reaching out to some of the cycling groups or bike clubs or things like that, I mean, we'd be glad to share their contact information too. So I guess there's kind of a variety of different ways to go with that.
I mean, to the extent that they have ideas, and then they could get in through into policy and eventually into a list somehow.
Right.
You know, like you're saying, that's what I was really driving at. I mean, it's great if they want to show up, and we love having more people here. But it's also the idea that it's actually giving some ideas that are then finding a way into actual projects.
Right.
And it's not just, I mean, I'm involved with the Safe Routes, too. It's not just bike paths. There's also sidewalks and other non-motorized.
Yeah.
No, they call it active transportation.
Yeah, and you raise a good point about that, too, that we kind of we're focusing on the bike issue right now, but we want to do a similar type of initiative with sidewalks and pedestrian type things, because we don't want that to get the short shrift, because I mean a lot of the reality is people, you know, there's going to be a lot more people, I think, wanting to walk. You know, it's a little easier, you don't need a bike to walk or anything. So
all right, anybody else have any comments, questions on the public bike meeting summary? If not, we'll go ahead and move on to item 5, which are selected policy committee agenda items. This is the famous yellow sheet that is in your packet.
Oh, we're going to the TIP?
Well, it's the attachment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was seeing it as other.
Yeah, it's there on the yellow sheet.
Yeah, too. No, proceed.
Okay. this is the final draft of the Transportation Improvement Program for fiscal years 2012 through 2015. And this is a very important document, as it's including all the dollars that are to be spent in those years. So Jason will fill us in on that particular subject.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. The Transportation Improvement Program, we do this document every 2 to 4 years, and what this is a listing of basically every project in Summit and Portage County using federal transportation funds. And if you did get the handout attachment 6C, instead of overwhelming you with the whole document, the most relevant part is the table showing all the transportation improvements that use federal funds. That's table H3. And basically this list summary-wise, there are about $687 million worth of transportation improvements in here. In the one question on bikes earlier, too, about the funding, when I mentioned the percentage of AMATS funding, putting it in context, there's a couple other bike projects that aren't funded by AMATS. I think there's around $10 million worth of bike improvements out of this close to $700 million in here. So that gives a little bit more of a kind of a proportion of where the bike projects stand. Public transit improvements that use federal funds are in here. Those are in table T3, I believe, T2 and T3. As far as how a lot of the funding is used, AMATS is actually, even though our policy committee is responsible for signing off on all federal transportation expenditures, that $20 to $30 million a year that we spend that I mentioned is a pretty small amount of all the federal funding that comes to the area. Most of the federal funding, the vast majority, comes through ODOT. Federal funding also goes to the county engineers, both in Summit and Portage County. And then occasionally comes directly to a community through a congressional earmark. Although, if you follow a lot of the discussions in Congress, they've had a lot of discussions about earmarks, and those are kind of fallen from favor. So there aren't as many of those in here. I thought what I would do, and just maybe give a little bit more perspective. We've talked about this at other meetings, but because the region has lost population, we have done a lot of transportation improvements in the last 10 years. If you think about the widening of I-77 through Fairlawn, the Route 8 project, which is almost done from Boston Heights up to Macedonia, quite a few other projects since the late 90s that have added lanes and improved freeways. The region has made, it's not like all traffic congestion has disappeared by any means, but the region has made pretty good strides with getting rid of a lot of congestion. So, and because a lot of local governments have no money right now, a lot of the emphasis has gone more to kind of fixing the roads that are out there. So instead of a lot of projects to add lanes or build a new interchange, we did have the Seasons Road interchange, but primarily most of the funding has gone to resurfacing roads, replacing bridges, replacing pavement and things like that. I think about $450 million of the close to $700 million has gone to highway maintenance in this document. And I just wanted to highlight a couple major projects that you might be interested in. Certainly, when I'm done, if you have any questions about anything in here or anything that's not in here, please let me know. But we are talking about bike trails. A couple of the projects in here are to complete the Portage Trail through Kent. So that's in here. We've got another project in Kent for Summit Street, basically through the campus. If you're familiar with that, that is not necessarily an easy street to navigate, either in a vehicle or on foot or on bike. It doesn't work very well at all. So AMATS put about $11 million into improving Summit Street that we awarded to the city of Kent. And that project...
Did they decide whether or not they're going to do roundabouts on
Summit yet? I think they're still working that out in the design. Yeah, like the general project is to coordinate the signals, to do kind of a median, to do some other things to make it more pedestrian friendly, and improve the intersection with Lincoln Street. But I don't think they've decided yet. I think there is a good chance that maybe some of the signals could go away and be replaced by roundabouts. But you could probably call Jim Bowling at the City of Kent for more information if you want, or I can give you his email address, too.
I'm just curious.
Okay. So that's some of the major projects in Kent and Portage County. One of the other ones that's actually been a project that's had difficulty being funding for a long time that we have in here is the bridge, Akron-Cleveland Road, over the bike and hike trail. Boston Heights has been trying to get funding for that project for a long time. And it's not even that it's such a large project, but one reason I thought I would highlight it is a community like Boston Heights does not have a lot of options for funding. You know, there's about 1,000 residents. in Boston Heights. It's difficult for them to raise tax revenue adequate enough to take on a $4 million project, almost $5 million project, but that is a project that they were able to get funding mostly from ODOT for. So that was good news for Boston Heights. There are a couple major projects in here for the improvements around the new Goodyear World Headquarters in Akron. We have a signal improvement on West Exchange and West Cedar Street in Akron. You might be interested that I know the city of Akron right now is looking at the feasibility of converting those streets back to two-way operation as opposed to one-way operation. They haven't made any decision on that yet, but that is something that's going to be looked at before the traffic signals are improved, because obviously if they go to two-way traffic, a traffic signal that only points in one direction isn't going to be what they need. So believe it or not, people do think about things like that. We've got a fairly major improvement on State Road in Cuyahoga Falls from Bath to Steele's Corners. If you're familiar with that, the area that kind of goes by Gojo and Allside, that pavement is in very bad shape. That's a fairly significant project cost-wise. We've talked a lot at past CIC meetings, really over the last 5 years, about when is somebody going to do something about Wolf Ledges and Grant Street and Broadway and Main interchanges and the Central Interchange. The short answer is there's not any funding out there for that right now. The city is continuing to work with ODOT on possibly closing a couple of those Wolf Ledges ramps as kind of a stopgap short-term measure. The longer term is there would have to be a rebuild of those interchanges. What is in here, though, is about, and this is just to kind of give you an idea how expensive just the maintenance can be, there's about $27 million worth of just bridge replacements for the bridges at the Central Interchange and at those interchanges, basically right over your office, Heidi. You're real close to there. Yeah, you guys are kind of in the shadow of that. But so that's one of the major freeway improvements. There's another one on the Ohio Turnpike. If you're familiar with the section of the Ohio Turnpike from just west of Route 8 into Streetsboro, that's the last part that's not three lanes in each direction. That's in here for $34 million. Those really cover most of the major improvements. Maybe another one to just illustrate the high cost of even some of the maintenance projects is there's a project on here for improving 4 miles of 271. This is just some bridge work and pavement replacement, and it's $55 million. So that's why, going back to our discussion about the transportation bill in Washington and everything like that, that's why a lot of the transportation funding is even though it's a very bipartisan issue as far as people, usually both political parties agree that it's important to maintain roads and bridges, There's a lot of infighting, not of a partisan nature, but just what share of the budget it goes to transportation and what kind of project should it be spent on. So I just wanted to illustrate, you know, these are high cost, and $55 million, the Cleveland Interbelt, I think, is $450 million. And, you know, you can easily have new beltways and interstates in the Sun Belt, like in Phoenix or Las Vegas, that are in the billion-dollar range. So after a while, it is big bucks. But I'll stop there with going through these. But if you do have any questions on what the document is or any of the projects, please let me know. Maybe just to add one thing, it's kind of interesting, and we've talked about this at CIC before too. And Mike, I know you were at our public meeting for the TIP, but we mentioned we had over 50 people between the two bike meetings. And I think at the meeting they have comments on the nearly $700 million being spent here. We had three people, including yourself, and also you were there too. So
and a reporter.
So I don't know that we actually had one person that wasn't from CIC or.
I got there late.
Yeah, that's were we already gone when you were?
We were wrapping up. I helped figure stuff out, but I tried to get there.
One thing I'd like to add to Jason's comments are, especially for the people who haven't been to CIC before, the TIP is a dynamic. In other words, we're going to ask for approval or the document, but when you vote for this document, you're not voting for it to be cast in stone for the next 4 years. It changes constantly. The figures can change, the projects can change. It's constantly being supplemented and revised. And through your input, while these fiscal years tick off, that's how things are improved. That's how they do get done. So I would stress to you, this is a lot of information. Please take it home. Please look at it. Please consider coming to future meetings with your ideas and comments on it.
That's a good point. If I could add one thing to that, just a great example of what you're talking about is you. A lot of you have probably read in the paper about the whole difficulty at Krieger's on Graham Road with the right-of-way. And that's one of the projects on here, but that the scope of that project is being revised right now by the city of Cuyahoga Falls based on the difficulty they've had acquiring the right-of-way. And so things get put in here at kind of a level of where they've gotten funding, but in to your question about the roundabouts, too, a lot of the design details and specifics, like what right-of-way gets acquired, from a public standpoint, there's definitely still time to weigh in on those kind of issues, as the people from Krieger's have done with that project on Graham Road. So typically that input comes more to the community. You know, AMATS hasn't received any comments on the Graham Road project. That's definitely been comments that have gone straight to the city of Cuyahoga Falls, which as appropriate because they're implementing the project. But
okay, Mr. Lottenbaum,
I can... you brought up the roundabouts a couple of times. I know in Indianapolis and around the suburbs there, they've been using those quite often. From what I can tell with mixed emotions, I've heard numbers that they're about $1 million a piece to put in with the engineering and that. What's the benefit of the roundabout versus the cost of either having a light or a stop sign?
I think the main benefit in usually why they're put in is the safety part of it. They virtually eliminate getting a, you almost have no possibility of getting an angle crash where somebody gets T-boned by another car. And they also lower the traffic speed enough that most crashes that would occur at a roundabout are not very severe at all. The other benefit, I think the main benefit that's usually stated is kind of more from a air quality or fuel usage standpoint, because people don't tend to be idling at a light. You know, they're generally a yield condition, so most traffic can kind of flow right through, especially for, they're much better at lower traffic volume intersections because of that. It is true that they'll be more expensive than doing just improving, say it's an intersection that was a four-way stop and you put a traffic signal, that's going to be much cheaper than putting a roundabout. However, if you have to do physical improvements to the intersection, like putting new turn lanes, a lot of times that can be the same cost as a roundabout. Most of the roundabouts that have been done in this area have been around the $600,000 range, so they've come in a little bit below that million-dollar figure. But that's still a lot of money.
And is the accident portion of that, is the number of accidents fewer or just the severity of the accident?
Typically the number of accidents is fewer, much fewer, and the severity is usually much less as well. So they have a pretty good track, at least in my opinion, they have a pretty good track record safety-wise.
Okay.
At the beginning, there's always low driver education about them. And so I think that's where you hear a lot of complaints because people don't know how to use them when they're new to the area. But after people get used to them, the safety is much higher.
So you see more accidents initially?
I don't think you see more, because the one at Ridgewood in Hametown hasn't had one accident since it was put in, and that's pretty good because it was getting a fair amount of accidents and a couple fatalities. But I think, like Heidi, what you're saying is it's not so much there's more accidents, but people just don't like it as much at the front end. Right.
But the good thing about roundabouts is it makes you slow down. You see a green light, and you can race through it and sometimes not. But a roundabout, you absolutely have to slow down to go into it. So the accidents are never going to be...
Or you'll end up in the middle of it.
Right. I've seen videos on YouTube.
But you're not actually ever stopping. I mean, especially if lower traffic volumes. So you actually, I mean, they get a lot of like traffic volume through, like just as almost more efficiently than a light usually, because people are paying attention. But you're never getting that like queuing, you know, the line of cars waiting nearly as much.
At the risk of saying county circles around
and around.
Yeah, the worst accidents, the longest lines.
No, that's an abomination. I don't know what that would be called.
Mr. Baker.
Speaking of Indianapolis, I was actually just there about a week ago. They actually, in one of their suburbs, they have a, they call it a tier dot, double tier dot. They actually have an expressway interchange that is a roundabout, two of them together. That's high, it was high traffic there. So
in Northern? Zionsville seems to have
Carmel, Indiana is one of the
cities. Carmel and Zionsville are right their neighbors, and they seem to have quite a few of them.
Yeah.
Nate's a former resident in Indianapolis. So.
All right. Do we have any comments or questions on the TIV itself at this point?
No.
Okay. Well, we're going to ask promotions, what this is on your yellow sheets.
This is Resolution 2011-10.
Correct. Attachment 6.
I move we approve Resolution 2011-10.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion from Mr. Mackey, a second from Ms. Kessler. Any discussion on the motion? If there is none, all those in favor of Resolution 2011-10 as submitted, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. We'll move next to item 5. The second item is discussion regarding proposal to lease the Ohio Turnpike. On the back, or on the table when you came in, there was a presentation which represents a slide presentation, I believe, pros, cons, and analysis of the question. And Nate will present us with some additional information on this particular topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good evening, everyone. We just want to spend a few minutes to talk about this. This is one of the hot-button topics in transportation these days. People are very opinionated about it. In our policy committee, they were very concerned about it. They wanted some information on it and would love to get anyone's input after the presentation here. I'm just going to kind of follow along with these slides here. There's a full report in your big packet here if you want a little more detail. Basically, anyone who's not familiar with the background of this issue, Governor Kasich, this has been proposed several times. He's the latest person to do it in our state. One of his mandates of being sworn into office was to do something to fill in the $8 billion budget gap in the state of Ohio's budget. And several ideas were thrown around. One of the kind of more controversial ones, highly discussed ones, was the leasing or sale of the Ohio Turnpike. The sale has basically been taken off the table now, so we'll just kind of focus on the lease of it. This has been done by states next to us. Indiana and Illinois have done this. And how they generally work is, you know, the state basically controls a toll road. And what they do, they lease it to a private company generally. Most of the ones historically have been foreign firms. There's a particular company that seems to take over a lot of these things. But for long periods of time, 75, 99 years, sometime in that range, they control the asset. They gain all the tolls. They operate it as a private company. And in return for that, the state receives a really large upfront lump sum of money, which they can use to do a lot of very expensive, you know, transportation projects or any other number of possibilities. So, basically trade off an asset for a long period of time, receive a nice large lump sum of money up front. The governor, he's shooting for about a $2.4 to a $3 billion range on this. That's the lump sum he's looking for. Anything less than that, he himself may think that it's not really worth doing. So there's a lot of questions about this, and we just kind of wanted to look into it, get some of the facts, the pros and cons of this, and kind of come to a conclusion here. A lot of things are happening really fast. Legislation just passed. There's a bill in the Senate now. So we kind of wanted to act on this, get everyone's opinion, and kind of be organized before it would happen so we can weigh in on this topic. It greatly affects our area. As I mentioned, two of our neighbors to the west have done this recently. Chicago leased their Skyway. It's a real short segment of the toll road, less than 8 miles. They got $1.83 billion up front for it. And in exchange for that, they leased it to a private company for 99 years. Also, in Indiana, they leased their turnpike, and that's a much longer one. It covers the whole state, 157 miles, and they received a $3.8 billion lump sum payment up front. With those proceeds, they were able to fund a large part of their 10-year transportation plan, and they got a lot of projects done quickly and very expensive ones that would have been very difficult to fund otherwise. Things comparable to our central interchange project and things. So that's one of the benefits of it. Speaking of the benefits, there are three main benefits that we see coming from the potential lease of the turnpike. The first one is obviously this very large upfront lump sum of money. You know, this comes in the billions of dollars and can be used for really expensive things. Funding is pretty short right now, and there's certain projects that are almost impossible to fund, and this is one way of accomplishing that. The second benefit would be different efficiencies could be reached. By switching from public employees to private employees, salaries could be saved. There could be efficiencies made in that. A private company may have better technology as far as automated tolling. I don't know if anyone on the turnpike is familiar with the Easy Pass. It's rather than, you know, sticking cash in the machine or to the cashier, you just kind of have an automated card on your car base, and you can just go right through and credit your credit card. A private company, sometimes they have the more modern technology, and they may be able to find efficiencies that way. And a third benefit is the turnpike currently carries $600 million in debt. I apologize, the slide says billion. With this lump sum of money, we could potentially pay off the entire debt of the thing immediately and still have quite a bit of chunk of change left over to take care of other communities around the state.
How is the turnpike right now set up to pay off that debt? Are they going to pay it off for 10 or 20 years? Is there any idea how long it's going to take to pay that off if nothing changes?
I think a little bit of the annual revenue it pays towards debt service. I have read a time frame as to when it's going to be paid off. Later on in the presentation, it has been paid off before, too. Some people may argue it would never be paid off. So,
Is that bonds? I mean, is that something?
Yeah, it was funded originally.
Typically, long-term bonds that have a fixed.
Yeah,
it's not like some bank can come and foreclose on the turnpike or
right,
anything
yeah.
like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it all goes to debt service. They issue bonds against the turnpike.
Okay.
So that's really three main benefits we could find. And the list of arguments against the Ohio Turnpike, it's a little lengthier. We'll go through them one by one here. The first one of the ones we're most concerned with, is trading a profitable long-term producing public asset to a private firm for this one-time windfall. Very different from the Indiana Turnpike and the Chicago Skyway, which were in pretty bad shape. They were pretty bad pavement conditions. They were not profitable. They were losing money. It made a lot of sense to privatize those toll roads. There was still some disagreement with that, but generally those went over pretty favorably. The difference between the Ohio Turnpike is it is very profitable. It's a very reliable stream of revenue that we receive. So that kind of changes the equation on things. Secondly, it's a
How profitable?
Well, in the last year that they made, after expenses, $92 million. Just in the 1 year, but it's roughly been about that for the last several years.
And those profits are banked, and that would be part of what would go to paying down the debt.
Yeah.
And that money's banked also for maintenance.
The 92 is not a net. The 92 is a before.
No, it's a it's
net.
A net.
That's taking
after paying the bond service.
That does not include bond service. We'll get to it later. We have a financial analysis later on. Bond service was left out. We replicated the methodology used by another group of researchers who looked at it several years ago.
Yeah, I have a question. Why do we do that? I know Stoneman does that a lot. Mm-hmm. If a private enterprise owned this, the debt service has to come off the revenue out the revenue side. And I don't understand why we do this, why we say we have $92 million when we haven't taken into consideration the $8.5 million in interest or whatever. Then, I don't understand why we talk like that, because it gives the the public sector, you know, telling the story that it's a better story than it was true.
Absolutely. A lot of this, we are just, yeah, I'm not going to pretend to be a CPA or financial analyst or anything like that. There were some economists from Cleveland State. They wanted to take debt out of the equation. They were just simply looking at like operating revenues and expenses. I'm not really sure why they didn't include debt there, and then just a leave of like a lump sum amount afterwards, so you can just kind of look at it that way.
I think, Nate, it's fair to say where the debt would come into play is if, say, $3 billion were obtained, it would actually be $2.4 billion, right? Because $600 million of that would immediately go to paying off
debt. Yeah, exactly. Part of the plan, if we get the chunk of money, definitely wants to go pay off the debt in one sweep.
So you said 90 before the debt, $92 million is what the Turnpike's been.
That was in 2009. We actually, there's a slide later on that gives the complete breakdown of revenues and expenses and everything, and we'll kind of go into pricing.
It's really not all that different than if you had debt, you know, like your mortgage, your outstanding equity, you know, minus your equity in your home, your outstanding, what you owe on your mortgage, you wouldn't necessarily subtract that from your after-tax and after-expense income, but it's always there waiting to be paid off, you know, as in this example.
Well, just looking at it real quickly, if it's $92 million, in case it's able to get $3 billion for it, you're basically, it's less than 3%. You know, I could put this in a reputable Wall Street account, possibly, around, it's a 3% return. So it's like, I don't see...
Well, I think what's at work here is to get an apples-to-apples comparison, because the question of leasing the Turnpike is really comes down to, can a private company come in and run it better than we're running it currently? You know, at some point they're going to have to go out and get replacement money as well. So debt is debt. This is basically a question of, can somebody come in and run this better than we are doing it right now? And so the question of debt is really, it's a sidebar. It's not, you know, it's not something that can be totally ignored. But to put the question fairly before the people, it's a question of who can run it better day to day. How much are you going to pay to use it day to day? Are you going to hit more potholes day to day? Those types of things. And I think part of the indications of what the people come in and say they can do when they come in and want to lease it or buy it can be done by us ourselves. The Ohio Turnpike Commission can automate toll booths. They can come up with certain efficiencies. So I think that's why the debt question, at least for the time being, is sort of a red herring in a way that to put the question before the people. That's the way I would see it.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, that's Ms. Mumford.
I'm sorry.
Okay. When they would lease this out and the state receives money for this, mm-hmm. is this a one-time, or is there a contract where they would be receiving more money as the years go on, or is it just a one-time lump sum that they receive?
It's possible. Generally, in every pre-existing case, other example of this, it's been like a one-time upfront payment. Government Casey has expressed interest in receiving maybe multiple payments, stream of payments that is unprecedented. And as we'll kind of get into, like it reduces the amount. That's just more risk that the private firm would be taking on, and would in the end kind of reduce the payments that we would give upfront for, which is one.
So if you lease it, you still own the asset, right?
You
so
do.
Still owns it. So couldn't there be covenants drawn into agreement with the private company?
Most certainly.
There actually are in the legislation that we passed. We do have the ability to take it back. That's I'm
right.
sure that would come with a penalty. You know, most likely they wouldn't agree to it otherwise, I wouldn't think. But absolutely, that's the difference from a sale. We wouldn't be able to receive an asset.
I've heard this presentation before, and I think that we ought to listen to this presentation because there's a lot of complexities that will come up further. And then I think we should talk about it, but I think first Nate needs to get through.
Okay.
Okay, why don't we move through the points, sort of condense them here, Nate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of bottom line it for
us. We need the discussion, not me telling them. Thank you. So basically, one of the concerns we have is it's a very long-term solution to address a short-term problem. This started off as a budget deficit, filling that gap, and that would fill the gap for one budget cycle and potentially give up the asset for 75, 99 years. There's kind of an extreme time mismatch with that. It's a solution with little correlation to the problem that it's addressing. Transportation may have led to the, some of the budget deficit, but it would only be a fraction of it. They'd be replacing a whole lot of things with the transportation aspect and maybe not addressing some of the other problems that are, causing the budget deficit issue. Basically, one of the third point that we have is that roads that were bought and paid for by Northern Ohioans, not just us in Northeast Ohio, also Toledo, and the duration of the turnpike, the leasing of it, the money could be used to benefit those elsewhere in the state. An example was the lease of the Indiana Turnpike. Having lived there, I know that a lot of the money from that was spent in Indianapolis, which is just like Columbus here, the capital city, central in the state. There were improvements, up north, but a disproportionate amount of the money went elsewhere in the state. They weren't the beneficiaries of that. The Turnpike has never received a penny of federal funds. It's a donor of state funds. It does get some of the money back. It gives fuel taxes to the state that are collected at the service stations that are on the Turnpike. It gives those to the state. It receives only a fraction of those, and those aren't actually reinvested back into the Turnpike. They instead are invested into the state roads that cross the Turnpike, in some cases intersect with it, but sometimes they don't even have to, the roads and bridges and things, so that money doesn't even go back to the Turnpike. So essentially, this road was bought and paid for by the users, and it seems fair only that the benefit should go back to those who paid for everything. Another negative of this is that it could actually harm the Northern Ohio transportation and logistics industries. A short-term lease may not have this effect necessarily, but when you start talking 75 years, 99 years, there's a possibility that a lot of the trucking companies located up around this way might find I-70 as a very favorable alternative. It might be worth them to leave the area and move down there for what would be considered to them a free highway, still taxpayers supported. Any highway would be, but might be much more appealing in their business model to do that. And we don't want to lose any business up this way to Columbus or Dayton if we don't have to. And the fifth and final argument we'll make against the leasing of the Turnpike is that toll increases would encourage trucks and other traffic to use parallel highways along the Ohio Turnpike. In every case that a Turnpike has been leased, tolls have increased substantially. And a difference between our Turnpike and the one in Indiana and the Chicago Skyway, those two highways have pretty much a captive audience. If you want to get through that part of the state heading up to Chicago, you pretty much got to take the Turnpike. You're kind of forced under there. There's not really an infrastructure paralleling that. Very different in Ohio. We have 303, 82, I-76, all of which, if tolls were a little bit too high for the trucking companies to swallow, they could, for short runs, take the 303s, the 82s, and for long runs may add additional traffic to I-76 through here, which is something that I don't think anyone really wants. Just for example, the Chicago Skyway, when it was privatized, tolls went from 50 cents to $2.50, and by 2017, they'll be fully phased into $5, so a tenfold increase in those. In Indiana, the easy pass tolls stay the same, but non-easy pass tolls, which would be your occasional user, would definitely use that. Just the cash tolls, those increase quite a bit as well. The Kasich administration does prefer to put caps on tolls. However, that once again would reduce the upfront payment we would receive from that extra risk that the vendor is assuming. So we're going to pay for that, in a reduction of our lump sum payment. And basically, just to note that any traffic that would be diverted from the Turnpike and runs on these other streets, any wear and tear that happens on the Turnpike has to be maintained by the company, the private company that would be leasing this thing. Once they move to these other streets, it's like it's a taxpayer burden. We're the ones that are going to have to put the building in to fix any wear and tear on 303 and the other parallel highways. One good thing is there is a check and balance built into the whole thing, is that they can only raise tolls so much. Otherwise, you know, all the traffic's going to leave the turnpike. So there is an incentive to not raise tolls an extraordinary amount. But this is hard to explain, but page 4 of your slides there's a graph. This was calculated and modeled by MOACA, our sister entity up in Cleveland. And the important line to look at is the very bottom one there, the one that goes downhill. That shows the sensitivity of truck traffic to toll increases. And basically what that line is showing, as tolls double on a toll road, just as they did in Chicago, truck traffic is reduced by 50%. They'll find alternative ways. That really cuts into their bottom line, and they react to that. So we have to be very careful. On the next page, this shows, get to the breakdown. This was replicated from a study that David Ellis and Ned Hill, I know Ned works for Cleveland State University, he's a really good economist. Back when Ken Blackwell was running for governor, he proposed the same leasing of the turnpike. So they ran a financial analysis on their most recent financial statements. That was a while ago, so we just replicated what they did in the latest available reports. That would be the 2009 financial statements from the Ohio Turnpike Commission. And as you can see, after operating revenue, the tolls and the money we receive from the concessions, you know, the snack bars and everything at the service plazas and things like that, and their operating expenses, salaries, maintenance, safety issues and things like that. In 2009, there was a net profit of $92 million. So just assuming that $92 million, the next slide, we kind of projected using net present value formulas, the potential payouts we could get, these upfront payouts that we could possibly get, just assuming that, you know, going forward that the turnpike is that profitable, kind of what we could expect for different time frames. There are two scenarios here. The one kind of to the left of the solid gray bar assumes that tolls are kept consistent. That's a highly unlikely scenario, but just to see the difference between the two. And everything to the right assumes a 3% increase in tolls. This does not necessarily account for depreciation of the dollar, inflation, anything like that necessarily.
And annually, right? 3% annually.
Yes, 3% annually. They don't tend to do that, but that's just one way of looking at it. Basically, to just make a quick summary of everything so we can get to the discussion, the next slide shows to reach the target set by the Kasich administration of $2.4 to $3 billion we have circled there, it would take roughly a lease of about 50 years for the one with toll increases. If it was steady, more like 75 years. And as we said, any additional risk that the private company takes on, you know, different conditions that we set, maintenance standards, toll caps, and things like that, it's going to reduce that payment because it's a little riskier investment for them. So we're even though no one seems to really want a long-term lease, to get that kind of money, it probably is going to have to be a long-term lease. So basically, just to wrap everything up for me here on this part, and we'll commence conversation here, our conclusion, we think the Ohio Turnpike is a consistently profitable, revenue-producing asset. And just as an example, in 2010, this isn't looking at anything else other than toll receipts, but they did reach an all-time record of toll receipts of $236 million. And this is during 2010, a recessionary year, and a year where gas prices were creeping up, you know, at a pretty fast pace. So all indications are that this thing is going to be profitable in the future. Also, as we said, any lease conditions that we have could reduce that upfront payment. So we need to find a nice balance in there somewhere. And one important thing is that a lot of promises regarding the turnpike have not been kept in the past. Nothing's to say this administration wouldn't keep any promises that they have, but when we're talking 75 years and multiple administrations, sometimes things change that we maybe didn't agree to in the beginning. One example of this is that when the turnpike was originally built, bonds were issued with the promise that once these bonds were paid off, the turnpike is going to be returned to the taxpayer as a traditional non-toll highway, like a 71, a 70, something like that. Well, as soon as it was paid off, bonds were reissued against the asset for maintenance and, you know, large projects and things like that. So we could use a large chunk of this money to pay off the debt right now, the $600 million. It sounds really good. But, I mean, who, with a lease, you know, we could take it back. We could reassume that debt, and that could have been $600 million wasted. Things like that have happened in the past, and that's why there's some skepticism among people that, you know, will the debt ever really be paid off? It's only time will tell. Also, just the one-time payment up front, it addresses the budget 1 year, but we pick up this asset for multiple generations, not necessarily 10 years, 20 years, 75 years. Three generations is a very long time. And also, there are really three ways that a vendor could benefit from this, could profit from this. The first one would be a substantial increase in traffic on the toll road, just paying the rates as they are. That's not too likely with a, you know, a low growth area here. You wouldn't expect a whole lot of increase of traffic. The second way they could do it, the most likely way they would receive profits from this venture, would be to raise tolls. But as we've shown before, that's highly likely to divert traffic to other streets. And the third one would be a reduction in, there could be a reduction in some good things, finding some efficiencies, you know, salary expense, just other good operating things. But what we don't want is a whole lot of reduction in maintenance expenses. We don't want it to, you know, that results in potholes and everybody kind of loses in that situation. So basically, when looking at the costs and benefits, a lot of things are still up in the air, but just taking this high view of everything, this faraway view, it kind of looks like a lot of the costs might outweigh the benefits, and why the AMS staff, from what we see, we're pretty much opposed to the lease of the turnpike. And we would love any questions or input that anyone else has.
Let me make
a comment. First of all, I want to reiterate what was said at the technical. This is an excellent job, and I appreciate it as a planner and also someone with financial background. The one problem I do have here, and this addresses your initial issue, this is not net revenue. This is gross revenue. This is cash on cash. It's a very important figure because it determines whether or not you can carry the debt. So if that helps to maybe clear up something there. But again, I want to reiterate that I think this was a great, great study.
As long as we're on debt, Nate, I noticed that the two companies that have gotten involved in this deal so far are Spanish/Australian companies, foreign interests. After, let's say, a deal like this would be done, what is to stop some company from, let's say, issuing $200 million or going after $200 million of debt? And spending $100 million on the turnpike and taking the other $100 million over to Melbourne or somewhere else, putting up office buildings and things like that. What stops that? What prevents that?
We don't really know. I mean, we can do all kinds of contractual things, you know, set all kinds of restrictions and things.
Right. There are all sorts of, like Nate said, there are all sorts of restrictions that can be built into the lease agreement. It's just what part of our feeling is, it's common sense. The more of those there are, the less amount of money the firm is going to pay. The more their hands are tied to have less freedom to do what they want with the turnpike, the less money the state would receive from it. And at some point, it gets to the point where it's not even worthwhile. And like one other point I wanted to make, Nate, just from your analysis that we talked about at this afternoon's meeting, is there's no guarantee. And the point was raised at TAC, and this is a valid point too, we don't know, but our point is yes, we don't know. And what we don't know is we have no idea where this money is going to go. The $3 billion, I mean, the original proposal from the administration was to reduce the $8 billion of debt. Well, the story has changed now, and now they're talking about maybe putting that money into the general fund, maybe putting it into transportation. There's no guarantee the money will even go into transportation, and there's also no guarantee that it'll come back to Northern Ohio. And I know our agency and our sister agency in Cleveland, in Toledo, in Youngstown, at least from a staff perspective, feel, look, if the lease goes forward, we're definitely going to lobby for making sure that that money, the bulk of it, comes back to this part of the state. We don't want to see it all go down to Columbus. And
to clarify one part of that, too, a House bill was recently passed, House Bill 153, that basically set up the structure for this program. They weren't even legally allowed to lease the turnpike until this passed just last Thursday. And I was just looking at it again this afternoon. There, one of the original things was that a lot of the money was going to be spent on transportation, but it sounded like some of it they wanted to divert to like a job training program and things like that. In the new legislation, there it does specify that the money, not only the money that would be received, also the interest earned on that money would have to be invested in a fund for transportation.
Okay, so that's a new development.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
and of course it could change in the Senate bill. It's hard to really say.
But one point that's been beaten home time after time is just in the budget for to run the state for the next fiscal year, they're short. Well, the figure starting out was $8 billion. Now with a little better economy, it's down to what, $7 or $6.6 billion. So that's just to operate. I mean, this is sounding like they're looking at it as some sort of windfall, which is just going to be divvied up amongst the backroom deals and everything else they can get done down there, the proverbial smoke-filled rooms. And so what good is it going to do the people? You know, in the end, it's just going to keep the state, keep the lights on, keep the doors open. And once that's spent, the money's gone. They can only pay it once. One other point I'd like to make as far as the resolution itself, if I'm understanding it correctly. AMATS is opposed to the sale or the lease of the Ohio Turnpike. So, when they ask for our approval, your affirmative vote will be in opposition to the sale or the lease. It's sort of one of those reverse ballot issues. You know, you have to understand what you're saying yes to and what you're saying no to. But the way I understand it, looking at it, is if you vote affirmatively to this, you are agreeing with AMATS to oppose the sale or the lease of the turnpike. So that I just want to put that out there so you understand what the vote's all about. Oh, do we have any other? Mr. Mackey?
Yeah. I haven't driven Indiana for a while, and it was really bad. Since it's been sold, has that road been improved? Has anybody driven over Chicago on it?
Nice.
It's a nice road.
From the Toledo area, from the western border, at least out through Elkhart, is in very nice shape.
That's not bad. It used to be a real bad one.
It's in very nice shape.
So selling, they obviously fixed the road up. Mm-hmm. Besides increasing the fares in Indiana.
Well, the tolls are not really, from what I can tell, there's not, I think it's from the eastern border over to Elkhart. I'm trying to think if that's 50 miles. Or I believe that toll is $7. So it's not, so, compared to the Ohio Turnpike, it's in the rates of increases we've got, it's not unreasonable.
Well, they got 75 years to do what they're going to do, whatever it is. Sir, can I have your name in the back? We haven't gotten
Scott
that on the record.
Buck.
Sorry?
Scott Buck.
Okay, all right. You had another comment?
Sir? Yeah, I just have a question, because I love the turnpike from the standpoint of you have the choice. You don't have to get on if you don't want to. You can take it. So my question is, with all the information we have for all the, you know, all the tickets and the transponders and everything, what percentage of the usage of the turnpike are what I call full rides from the east gate to the west gate? Do we have that kind of information, like who was using, you know, do the truck drivers get on Cleveland and go west and go east, or do we have a lot of guys coming out of Pittsburgh that are doing full, what I call full rides?
How many people are the whole 241 miles?
Yeah, because of all these people that are using my turnpike are from out of state, I think it's a great thing. I think the user tax is you're using my turnpike, you know, to get yourself into Chicago and all that. And I think you know, as long, you know, that's a burden, that's less of a burden on the Ohio taxpayer. So I just wonder if those statistics are available, that who really uses our turnpike.
I mean, basically,
how much of it is truckers, you know, versus cars,
Well, do they have a website?
It's an excellent
statistical. Do they have a statistical table on their website? Is there a website for the Turnpike?
Yeah, well, the Ohio Turnpike Commission has a really good website with all kinds of statistics, their financial statements and everything. I don't have that split. I'd be fascinated to learn.
That's an excellent question. I would suspect, and this is just, the Turnpike will be a little bit different because it is disproportionately compared to, say, like an I-71 or 77 trucks. There's a lot more truck traffic. But typically with most freeways, and I just say this from having a transportation forecasting background, people always overestimate the number of people that are actually on. That's why I'd be fascinated to see the actual number. They always overestimate the number of people that actually are going all the way on a road. For example, when
we have the data now.
Right. And that would be good to look at. I'm just saying, like, when we did the commuter rail study from Canton to Cleveland, people would look at the 80,000 vehicles on I-77 and be like, there's 80,000 people out there, and they would always be assuming most of them are making that trip. And you would look at the reality on I-77, and I think it would be out of that 80,000, like 2,000 people actually going all the way from. But I bet it's higher on the Turnpike, and I'd like to look into that.
I've actually seen those figures, and unfortunately, I can't remember. But what I do remember, and this is on freight studies, and we're doing freight studies on rail now too, is what I see is trucks going from one side of the state to the other. And I see that as lost business for us. Okay? Because those trucks are hauling stuff to manufacturers and sales points. It's being sold here in Ohio. So there's another way to look at that.
But how does that affect the sale of the Turnpike?
How does that affect the sale of the Turnpike? Well, probably doesn't affect it at all. So now that somebody else gets the tolls and they're just driving through Ohio,
yeah, we've got to pay for gas
when they go off the road.
Right. I understand your point, but I don't think it's valid for the usage part of the Turnpike. I totally agree with you.
I see it as lost. What I'm saying is it's lost revenue to us. Okay? I mean, we're the ones that we have to pay for, you know, whether they're riding on the Turnpike or riding on the side of the road. I think we're getting
economic
into the side
development. You're talking about economic development. You're talking
right.
about
right.
just it could be on planes going over the state. It could be on boats on the lake. But
right.
it's economic activity versus the who's going to own the asset on the ground. The
Turnpike side didn't determine where that business located. Yeah.
Okay, Ms. Carney back here, I believe. Is that
yes.
right? You've been very patient. What's your comment?
First of all, we as Ohio taxpayers do not pay taxes to the Ohio Turnpike. People who use the Turnpike pay for it. And I work for the Ohio Turnpike in Boston Heights. And the Turnpike Commission has a breakdown of transactions at each gate. I don't know how much deeper you can go and find out how many are from Westgate to Eastgate, but many of them get off in the Toledo area to fuel. So they are spending money here, and that's not on the Turnpike. They don't buy it on the Turnpike. And a lot of them stay, but when the tolls go up, they get off the roads. And in the leases, I looked when Pennsylvania was going to be leased. The consortium backed out because they realized they couldn't make any money. That was in 2009. And I read the proposed lease of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, all 75 pages, and it's to their advantage. You can't toll one bridge. You can't build a new road. You can't toll anything in Ohio as long as they have their hands on that. People have told me that drive from Indiana and Chicago in the wintertime, they're so happy to get to the Ohio Turnpike because at least it's flat. So, I don't know.
The Turnpike's in the snow belt.
Well, so is ours.
Well,
I drove from Toledo to Eastgate for 2 years in the snow. And at least on the Ohio Turnpike, you had a shot at having one lane clear.
Well, we appreciate your comments. Thanks for those.
I have some more facts if anyone's interested. that was someone at the turnpike, someone not from the commission, but someone that works put these facts together.
Do you have extras to hand
yes.
out? Okay. Also, maybe you can answer this question that came up. If somebody really wants to dig deep to find out how the turnpike determines the trips and the length of the movements and everything, is there somebody in the turnpike organization or some department?
Would be the engineer. I don't know how much information. Lauren Hakos, HAKOS, is the spokesperson for the turnpike at ohioturnpike.org.
ohioturnpike.org. Okay. Keep that in mind. Mr. Lottimel?
She brings up a good point. I don't know if you have the statistics on this, but on the toll roads that were sold, was there a decrease in the truck traffic or the movement of merchandise?
Well, I think that's a tough one to answer.
Did you come across that, Nate, in your research?
I didn't exactly. It's kind of a different situation because they don't have the parallel roads. They're leading to Chicago, which is, you know, a draw, like, you know, very different than maybe anything around here. But I believe the sensitivity analysis that NOAACA did, that wasn't, I believe, just looking maybe at our area. I'm not really sure.
I think that analysis, I think, was just looking at our area.
It is just ours, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to truck out of here, 76, go through Lodi, cut west, then drop down to 30 and just run on into Chicago that way. Never have to pay the toll as long as the weather was good. The weather was lousy, I think.
I
was thinking about it. I don't care.
Yeah, so, I'm a truck company owner.
So anyway, we've raised here before the fact that Ohio is like a conduit for trucks traveling through. I mean, Ohio is like a crossroads area for all kinds of truck traffic, and we have to maintain the roads. I think we see enough studies talk about the crumbling of the infrastructure of America. In fact, we built all these interstates, and now we've got to go back and rebuild all the bridges and the roads because there's no way to fund it unless you put tolls on them, on the roads, or you raise gasoline taxes or something else to get in here to repair everything you need to repair it. Now, the Ohio Turnpike is a self-maintaining road in a way. All right? Now, if you want to toll road everything in Ohio to fix all the interstates in Ohio, that should solve the transportation budget as far as the basic goes, but I don't think you've got the will to do that. So I want to move on to the vote. We've got a lot of discussion.
Roger, thanks for coming tonight.
I think I just called a question.
Okay. I saw Mr. Baker's hand, so in fair play, I think we should... No, you're okay? All right. Well, on your agenda, this is attachment 6A, resolution 2011-08, and again, AMATS is coming down on the side of opposition to the sale or lease of the Ohio Turnpike, and they're asking you to approve that particular position. So do we have a motion on... the resolution. Ms. Kessler makes the motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Mr. Baker is the second. All right. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of resolution 2011-08, opposition to the sale or lease of the turnpike, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. So the CIC will go on record as opposing the sale or lease of the Ohio Turnpike. Okay, moving on to an item that we're going to also put under agenda item number 5, and that on your yellow sheet is attachment 6F, resolution 2011-14, Northeast Ohio Sustainable Communities Consortium Agreement. I'll just read this quickly so that we can get on to the discussion. Resolution 2011-14 allows AMATS to join the Northeast Ohio Sustainable Communities Consortium for the purpose of developing a sustainability plan that integrates planning strategies for housing, land use, transportation,
community development, environmental protection, infrastructure, and economic development in the 12-county northeastern Ohio region. The staff recommends approval. Now, the reason this has been brought up to agenda item 5 is that the positions have been maintained by an exchange of emails, and I think for the purpose of not only fairness but information, that Alex Kellerman, our vice chair, makes an initial presentation on this particular item. And I'll turn the floor over to Alex, and then if there are any comments, I would like to start with the AMAT staff, if that would be the fair thing to do after Alex presents his observations to this particular issue.
Well, if I could, I appreciate the opportunity to speak first, but I'd like to make a modification, if you don't mind. My position in the email was that that this particular resolution would be tabled at this point. So that is what I would like to, that's what I would like to vote on, is to simply table this discussion until August, at which point the questions that I would raise would hopefully be answered. But I think it would be probably more instructive to everyone if they actually heard the pro side or why we should approve this, and then we can go from there. Because otherwise I'm bringing up points and...
Okay, so you're basically...
I'm yielding to the issue.
You're yielding to the MS staff.
Right, I mean, I don't look at this as oppositional. I'll have a particular point of view that I'll bring up, but it makes more sense to hear what that actually is first, and then we'll go from there.
So, Alex, do you want me to explain a little bit about what this thing is?
Yeah,
I think it makes your concerns or points animate them a little bit more, because... people have an idea of what you don't need any help. Okay, well, and I'll make this pretty brief, because I know we're getting a little bit late in the evening, although we'll be here as long as you guys are willing to. But a little background: back in August of 2010, AMATS entered into a memorandum of understanding with about 20 other entities throughout the 12-county Cleveland, Akron, Canton, Youngstown region to co-sponsor and submit a grant application to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development under its Sustainable Communities Program. And I'll explain what that is in a second, but to make a long story short, we put this application together for this program in October. We received an announcement from HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, that Northeast Ohio was awarded $4.25 million in a planning grant to look at a lot of the issues that Mike mentioned. It's basically, the purpose of the grant is to develop a cooperative regional sustainability plan that integrates housing planning, land use, transportation, water and sewer infrastructure, environmental issues, and economic development. Now, that is a very broad planning paradigm in a very large region. So, one of the issues that the consortium's dealing with is, what does all that mean for Northeast Ohio? And I think that's going to be part of what the three-year grant is for. But, I mean, essentially a lot of this, at least, and this is in my opinion, as one of the current signatories of the MOU, I can't necessarily speak for the other 22 entities that are part of it, but My opinion of a lot of what this money is to go to is not necessarily to do even though ostensibly we're being funded to do a plan, is I think what we're really trying to do is look at better ways to get people from throughout the region to communicate on planning issues. And yes, a paper plan will be done as part of
memorandum
that.
Memorandum of understanding.
Oh, I'm sorry. Memorandum of understanding. Yeah.
And work for the government.
Stop me if I throw out other acronyms. I usually try to be pretty cognizant of that. So a lot of this, to me at least, is about getting communities to talk to each other, collaboration. Quite honestly, I think a lot of this could have been done without this grant. I mean, the grant was an opportunity to do this. But just like a lot of the issues we've talked about communities, you know, they're adjacent to each other, not coordinating on regional planning. And we had the Walmart discussion, the report that Nate wrote, you know, with Fairlawn and Copley and Bath all being right next to each other, and there's a stark lack of cooperation. I don't think a plan like this can make anyone collaborate, but I think having the discussion about better cooperative planning is important. So I'm definitely supportive of it. And Alex definitely, I think, has some legitimate issues to raise about it, which I'll turn over in a second. A little bit more background, the members of the consortium are the four metropolitan planning organizations, so AMATS, as well as our sister agencies in Cleveland, Youngstown, and Canton. About six of the 12 counties, the city of Akron, city of Canton, city of Cleveland, city of Elyria, city of Warren, city of Youngstown, so most of the larger cities. The Cleveland State University, three of the housing authorities, the Regional Prosperity Initiative, and the Fund for Economic Future, which is a philanthropic organization that helped kind of organize the effort to apply for this grant. Like I said, I think it's a valuable opportunity for the region to look at planning together. I think it could actually, if done right, and that's a big caveat, but I think if done right, it could actually save a lot of money on the cost of government by improving the way that public services are delivered, and foster a lot of intergovernmental cooperation. And as a regional planning organization, and one of our main tasks is to try to foster intergovernmental cooperation. So specifically what this agreement is we had the memorandum of understanding to apply for the grant. Now that our consortium of the 23 entities has received the grant, the Department of Housing and Urban Development wants us to enter into an actual consortium agreement saying we've received this money and we're going to work together is basically what the resolution in the attached documentation says. So with that, and to allow enough time here, I'll turn it back over to you, Mike, and then to Alex.
Okay, thank you, Jason. I would only ask that because there are millions of dollars in federal funds obviously coming into the picture pretty early, and Alex, I don't want to use the expression tipped his hand, but he certainly was nice enough to honestly present the fact that he's preferring to table the issue. Could you speak to the time, the urgency, or the time constraint of using the money, or whatever else might impact a tabling of the issue at this point would impact?
Well, HUD, Department of Housing and Urban Development, wants all the consortium members to have this agreement in place by June 1st. So from that standpoint, it affects our ability to enter into this. Having said that, I am very skeptical that all 23 of those entities are going to approve some sort of resolution like this by June 1st, because we've only got 3 weeks to go. So I don't think that's I wouldn't recommend tabling it, obviously, because we recommended approving it, but it's not some sort of a fatal flaw.
Okay. All right. So I want to sort of crystallize the decision issues here for you, and I'll turn it over to Alex. But this is your chance to go on record here as far as how you see this, if you won't. Obviously, if there are some of you that want further time to study it, I have to be honest, that's sort of where I'm at in this whole thing. Then obviously, you're looking at speed as possibly a detriment to a good final result. If you feel that, because of the needs of our communities and our region, that we need to move ahead, well, that is another position. But at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Alex and let him define his position again and a little bit more why he'd like to see the action taken.
Well, first of all, I'm not here to debate the Sustainable Communities Initiative. I was there at the meeting, the last monthly meeting they had, and I intend to go to the next one as well. There I'm speaking basically from a business perspective to see if business interests are represented. When I'm here tonight, I'm speaking for a resident of Summit County of the AMATS region.
this group is a citizens involvement committee. So what we decide, well, it's important. It really has no binding on what actually happens in policy. I mean, the policy committee makes that decision. We're just sort of signing off on it, in essence. So if we vote yes, we vote no, we vote table, it doesn't change the dynamics of what's being applied. My concern, Jason is the vice chair. I have great respect for him and for the MS staff and for the people that are actually involved in the application. There were a lot of cities that competed for this, a lot of metro areas, I should say. And Northeastern Ohio was one of the ones that was able to get that. My concern is, as I sat at the meeting there, and if you look through the packet that's attached to 14, and you'll see further down in the other committees, that there was so much discussion, and part of it's by design of HUD is sort of the lead agency on this, that I think they were originally their baby, and then they brought in the transportation and the EPA, about that, you know, the different groups be represented, and there's a discussion of which ones will get a vote and which ones will not get a vote, which ones have to contribute much money and which ones will not. And as I've sat there and I listened to these mayors and all the other people talking about all things, and they said, well, what about the labor union? What about this group? And I think, well, you know, where are we in that discussion? Where is the suburban area? Where is the Summit County in that discussion? You have the Archdiocese of Youngstown. You have the Hispanic Coalition over here, and you have that group over there. All those are mandated by HUD, by the way. But there's no mandate that we have any say at all. Now, I don't doubt that we will have some kind of input, but it's not there in what we're talking about tonight. And that's all I'm asking right now is by tabling, we're saying, hey, look, we want to make sure that we have a say in this process down the road. And it doesn't change, as I said, whether it goes forward or not, it'll go forward more than likely. But it just puts them on notice to say, look, we're concerned as well that we have an equal voice in the process.
Okay.
So that's pretty much
my concern is that we send the strongest possible message that reflects the feeling of the people that participate. And the danger that I see in tabling the issue is that we put the issue back another 90 days, whatever it is, but then it ultimately moves in some direction with or without our opinion. So I really see two votes here, or two ways to vote. And this is going to be reflected in your motions. If you feel a certain way, that time is of the essence, that we need to have a voice, that the policy committee is going to look at the interests of the region and express themselves accordingly, then you have to vote that way. If you feel it needs further study and want to take a personal interest and consider the issue privately and study on your own timetable, that equates to another one. So I guess the thing to do, if there is nothing left to be said by either AMATS or Duke, okay, we're going to open the floor. And Ms. Mumper, it was kind of a draw, but we'll take ladies first, Al, if that's all right. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I found is it never pays to be in a hurry. And I think that Mr. Cullen has a valid question and concern. The other thing is, after sitting here and listening to all of this, I have to tell you I have serious concerns about sustainable development. As I looked at the three things, the different topics you've discussed here this evening, one about the roundabouts, and sustainable development has three areas, and it's the social, the environmental, and economic. So the environmental part, you were saying about the roundabout, and we would save on gasoline and air pollution. Then we talked about the economical, uniting private companies with government. And I see that as creating a monopoly, and I do see it as limiting business. And I see lots of federal control, and usually when the federal government gives you money, there's a lot of strings attached. The bottom line is, I see the taxpayer coming out with exorbitant fees for all this, and the government becoming larger and receiving more funds. that was my take on what I heard for this evening. But as far as Mr. Cowan's recommendation, I would hope that he would take one for one.
Okay, I saw a hand from Mr. Kalish over here.
Yeah, why do we have to contribute $69,000 for each participant?
That's
4.2 million.
Is a condition of getting the grant, each signatory to the consortium when we signed the memorandum of understanding. Each agency pledged a $23,000 per year in-kind contribution, so that's actually not cash. That's basically me and my staff, the time that we devote to working on the project. So if you took our salaries plus benefits and you evened it out over the course of a year, we're basically devoting $23,000 worth of staff time. So in that sense, it's in-kind because it's we're being paid regardless of whether we're working on the Sustainable Communities Project or on bike planning or on developing the TIP. So I don't want to say it's not real money, but in that sense, it's an in-kind contribution, if that makes sense.
Okay. Mr. Laudermilk?
Yeah. And I had a similar concern where we've gone from getting a grant to signing up to paying a portion of the cost, and in kind or not, that money that you're being paid is coming from the taxpayer somewhere.
That's correct.
Mistaken, right? So this isn't money that doesn't exist. There's money being spent at a time when there's not money for roads that need to be replaced and things like that to create another entity that's going to suck away dollars, time, effort from those areas that need to be addressed currently. And I would agree with Mr. Kelman at the very least that it be tabled, and I don't know if I'm able to make that motion. I would certainly do it.
Okay, Mr. Buck.
Mr. Kelman, are you going to delay the vote to instill more power for us or a stronger voice, or are you just willing to table it? I'm kind of confused. You made a comment that you feel we don't have a lot of say in it anyhow. So are you wanting to table it so that we can get our troops together to, if there's a, you know, enough opposition to it, to have some kind of power to influence the decision? Or?
I'm not sure if it's power so much. I mean, the one thing also about it is because it's such a, it's the first time they've ever done it, federal government. And it's sort of like, in a way, it's kind of like a mirror that you hold up and everyone sees it a different way. There's a lot of language in there in the actual bill when it was first written that would make your hair stand on end if you're really into that. And as a matter of fact, when I was at that meeting, a lot of the people that were talking, the executive director of Sustainable Communities is...
Hunter Morris?
Hunter Morrison was sort of backing away because there are some of the languages real level community. They're talking about social equity and economic this and, you know, and they were sort of like, okay, well, yeah, okay, we'll do that because we know we have to address this part and housing is part of it because HUD's giving us the money and we want to make sure that we have equitable housing opportunities for everyone and joining, you know, transportation with jobs and with housing. And, I mean, all those are... they're admirable goals, and I certainly think that there's a benefit to the program. That's why I didn't want to debate all the merits of sustainable communities. I was just saying that from the standpoint of the way it's set up, because it is sort of loose, that the requirements that are there set by the federal government don't require our participation at all. And so I was hoping that in between now and in August, three more meetings that they would have, that would be sort of solidified, that we could come back and say, okay, now here's something, here's what it actually looks like for us. Because, you know, reality is we're not going to be able to decide that ourselves. And the other reality is whether we vote yes, as I said, whether we vote yes or no, it's going to keep going on. We're just sending a message, I guess, that says, hey, we're out here too. I'm sorry?
We're a speed bump?
Yeah. I don't know.
Mr. Mackey.
I have a question. You said that you attended the meeting and so much was amorphous and not spelled out, but you also said something like the Catholic Diocese of Youngstown and the Hispanic record had to be included in this community, sustainable community package.
When we put the consortium together, as you can see, it's almost entirely all public agencies,
right.
And HUD wanted to have some diversity on that, and by that they meant a couple. They did mean trying to get some business interests. I think Alex raises a fair point. The business, there's a couple. Like First Energy and Dominion and SUMA have been invited to participate, but most of what HUD's interested in is, because of a lot of HUD's programs focus around people with low incomes, minority communities, most of what they meant by diversity was they wanted to see people on the board that represented the interests of those communities. So they weren't dictating who you got, but Our task, basically, before our consortium was fully formed, was you need to go out and get a couple people that aren't just government people. You need to get community groups, people that represent people with low incomes and minorities, etc. And I think, I don't want to put words in Alex's mouth, but that's still a pretty narrow, that's a narrow constituency out of the whole general population. But I think from HUD's perspective, that is a constituency that they're always interested in serving. So that's why those particular groups were included. If this were all up to me, I don't know that I would have done it that way. But that was kind of what...
I'm going to say, HUD put out this proposal, time-wise now, and then back in October, we had the 21 or 23 members agreed to make this consortium based on what HUD said. Now you had another meeting with HUD, and they're changing the game by saying, well, you got to add all the rest of this in.
Yeah,
I don't think they really changed it.
I think it was, when we put this together in August, we had basically a month to get all these. It's pretty extraordinary. We got 23 government, well, they're not all government, but 23 primarily government agencies to do anything in a month. And to all agree on something. Already be unheard of.
So we agreed to make a consortium, and now we went to a meeting, and HUD is filling in the fine details, saying, here's the way you actually have to do
it. Right. Their intention was always to have community groups, social service groups involved. It just took us some time to identify those groups. And we had a lot of discussions about getting some from Youngstown, some from Cleveland, some from Akron, for trying to have kind of a geographical representation.
Don't the MPOs already fit this need when we have a construction project that talks about addressing equal opportunity?
Environmental justice. Yeah, I think from a transportation standpoint.
Yes.
But I think
from this.
Yeah, I think from HUD's perspective, and again, I'm not here to be an apologist for HUD because I think a lot of the collaboration, quite honestly, we could do in our region for free. But I think this money will help with some planning. But I think from HUD's standpoint, that they want to have those groups at the table more for issues of housing. You know, for example, how do you get people on welfare employed and get them to work? There's a transportation component with transit service and things like that. But there's also issues of, you know, people live in Akron. They want to work in an industrial park in Twinsburg. How do they get there? Those are the kind of issues I think HUD also is emphasizing on top of. Having said that, we have a lot of freedom with this, and I think it's good Alex is attending the meetings because we'll see how it plays out. But personally, I think, yeah, there are some strings on it, but we've got quite a bit of freedom to design this plan for our region how we want. And there is a caveat in the resolution that I wrote in. I'll just read that part real quickly. From an AMAT standpoint, it says this committee is free to adopt or reject any recommendations which may emerge from the regional plan based on whether it feels those recommendations are or are not in the best interest of AMAT's members. So as far as our plan is concerned, I don't feel that there's going to be, this isn't a question of the federal government telling us what to do. We're going to be developing this plan. We're free to adopt or not adopt any recommendations out of this. This isn't going to be policy from Washington as far as the sustainable plan for Northeast Ohio.
Before I take your comment, Mr. Loudermilk, I'd just like to say also that
with any issue that comes up that where there seems to be a real groundswell of opinion, you know, negative, positive, or whatever it is, the policy committee normally meets on the Wednesday after our meeting, which means they'll be meeting next Wednesday.
May 18th, yes.
May 18th. Now, what we've done is, if there's something that really presents a position by the CIC members, I've appeared before the policy committee on this particular issue, and Alex, you can knock me down right now if you want to, but Alex is so much more knowledgeable that before we take any votes, do you feel that you'd be willing to appear before the policy committee next week? And,
is it noon or something you said?
Pardon? I'd have to check my calendar.
1:30 at the Martin's.
Yeah, side. I mean,
is that a possibility?
Yeah, I think that's an option.
Okay. All right. Mr. Laudermill?
Yeah, I think, I guess the first thing I'd like to ask is if you can distill down in layman's terms, what exactly does AMATS and Region, what's the goal? What's the end game? And what benefit do you expect to get out of this?
Oh, this project particularly.
Yeah, what's the goal of it, first of all, and what benefit is there for you and the residents?
What I'd like to get out of it specifically is when local governments make decisions on zoning, I'd like to see the zoning done in a way that looks at the transportation system, doesn't zone land for more intensive uses than what the road can handle traffic-wise. That would be one example, because then when that happens, taxpayers end up spending more money to widen roads for development decisions that are made. I think most of my interests are definitely transportation related. I think the region could do a lot better job of, when developments are built, making sure those developments are pedestrian and bike friendly. Also dealing with issues like access management, which governs the driveway spacing you get along a given arterial corridor. For example, if you drive Howe Road, you have driveways constantly, traffic turning out in and out, it causes congestion, it causes safety problems. A lot of times roads like that, like it's like that in Montrose with 18, half the roads in Copley Township, half the roads in Bath Township. I think the project can be a catalyst for getting those communities to sit down together and looking at things from more of a regional perspective, not just Copley looking at Copley, because the reality is what goes on in Montrose along 18 affects more than just Copley and Copley residents. So for me, it's kind of those infrastructure decisions, getting better coordination and more thoughtful planning and improving collaboration and cooperation between local governments. That's what I would like to see come out of the project.
I guess the other is, how often or where is it that's advertised that this group or AMATS or any has been formed or given the public, like council meetings and things like that, you give public notice and encourage. Is that typical of something like this where the residents should be aware this is going on and be able to come in and have a say on it? Or is this something that you'd have to be part of this group to know that it's happening? Because what I'm hearing from you is you're talking about you'd like to have a say in land use, which most of the land you talked about is probably privately owned, and then dictating what a person can or can't do with his own property. So I think there's probably a lot of things, there probably does need to be a lot more discussion, especially since you're going to be using taxpayer dollars to do this, and you've got communities signing up and agreeing to pay and spend their local tax dollars to fund this. I think at the very least, there should be a lot more discussion, and there should be some type of advertising or community awareness.
Well, Mr. Laudermill, yeah. First of all the AMATS meetings are advertised in the paper, okay? And when we get together, there's a table in your packet which will show the dates of all the meetings, both past and future, for our year. Then, through your participation in CIC,
that's where we all get educated about, you know, what is going on out there. A lot of the things that are going on, there's a thing called the RPI that you'll see in your list about this consortium, the Regional Prosperity Initiative. That's another thing that's sort of out there. It has the backing of a lot of public officials, and there are a lot of points of view about that particular ongoing effort. So it's through forums like this that you kind of find out about these other things. So that's why I would encourage you to come back, become a member of CIC, and express your opinion. But what we need to do is to get a voice from this group right here about what we do with this resolution. And, you know, if we have answered most of the questions, I think it might be time to gauge the position of the group. And if that merits an appearance before the policy committee, we're certainly willing to do that. Now, what they will do is up to them. They answer directly to the voters. Most of those members are elected officials. And, you know, if we don't like what they do, we certainly have our opportunity. We have to wait for it. But we have our opportunity to express our voice, our vote. So unless there are some other question or position or comment, we'll start to entertain motions on this resolution.
Did you clarify the voting procedures for the new attendees that only CIC members can vote? And you have to attend two meetings?
Okay. Is that two consecutive meetings to become a member?
I don't think it's two. I think it's just two within a year.
Two within a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what we're saying is that the voting will be restricted to those people who have been to two MAS meetings in a year, and they are members of this committee. So I don't have all the roll calls with me.
Well, the one thing also is a clarification, is a point. There are two ways to be involved with the CIC. One is to come to two meetings.
Right.
And then I guess there's some, they send you a letter or something.
Right.
That's how I'm on. I'm from Hudson, but Hudson, I'm not representing Hudson. Now, the other is that an elected official can send you as a representative. I think Audrey's representing the
Commissioners.
Portage County Commissioners. And the gentleman there was from Metro, and who else?
Heidi represents Summit County Engineers.
I'm sorry?
Macedonia.
And from Macedonia. So those people are sent by, they can come and go as they please because they're sent by their elected representatives as their person here. So that's the other way you can be here. But and anyone's welcome, but what they're saying is as official as, I mean, to keep it official as far as the CIC in terms of a vote, a binding vote, it has to be someone who's a member. Right?
Right, that's
correct. Okay.
So you want me to put a motion? I mean, I hear we can do Robert's Rules of Order. Do you want me to make a motion to table it, or do you want to make a vote to vote on the issue as it is, or how do you want to do that? It does
well. I see it three different ways. You can make a motion in favor, you can make a motion against, or you can make a motion to table it until a future meeting. Either those are the choices.
Well, the table seems more neutral, I guess. So I'll go ahead and make that motion.
We have a motion to table resolution 2011-14 until the next meeting. I'm sorry?
Second.
Mr. Kalish is the second. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of tabling resolution 2011-14 until our next meeting, which is scheduled for Thursday, August 11th, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Do we have a...
I think we need a majority. Okay. I don't
care who counts. It's a hand count.
Okay. Okay, we have...
It's like you have
four,
I think.
Four. Four tabled. Okay.
And against?
We need a resolution.
Well, no, you're voting on this.
Well, you need to get the nays.
All the nays on the tabling. Okay, the nays against tabling resolution 2011-14. Okay, we have one, two, three.
Any abstaining?
Just to throw one more wrinkle.
You're going to run up by Robert's rule of order.
You're right.
Anybody want to abstain on the tabling issue? Okay.
I think the ayes will have it.
The tabling Yes, the ayes have it, 4-3. So we have voted 4-3 to table the issue.
Well, what we'll do when it's presented at the policy committee next Wednesday, we will convey the CIC's recommendation to table, try to do our best to kind of convey what some of the concerns were, but Alex, not to require even more of your time, but I think like Mike said, if you're able to attend, I think you'd probably be a more articulate spokesperson for some of the concerns, maybe than I will be. But if you can't make it, the staff will try to.
I wasn't sure. I wasn't on my calendar.
Another option would be, too, if you can't come, but you want to try to get some of these things to, in the committee members' hands, if you want to send me an email, I can make sure that it's distributed. Okay. To everybody too. That way, you might not have to take time out of your.
As I said, in closing, I didn't look at anything personal or anything about. I mean, this is a citizens committee, and I thought that we should express an opinion. So.
If we wanted you guys to have the same opinion as the staff every time, we might as well not even be here. So that's understood.
I just wondered what paper is it in that you. Tell people about these meetings.
Akron Beacon Journal.
In the Kent Ravenna Record Courier, in the Akron Beacon Journal, and we place ads the Thursday before each meeting. And then any decision of the policy committee meetings, like were mentioned, that's where all the elected officials come together to vote. Those are open to the public. If you ever want to come to one of the meetings, those are advertised on our website. We can put you on for 5 minutes at the beginning of the meeting, just address the committee, so you have an opportunity, which quite honestly, I think especially for an issue that's really important to you that you want to have an impact on, that meeting is very good to come to because they're all there, they're all sitting there. We set it up so they have to listen to you for 5 minutes. They might not respond. I can never guarantee that they'll engage with conversation, but they are... You know, the public always gets to the beginning of the agenda to make comments.
Okay.
Do you put it in the Stowe Sentry?
We don't put the CIC ad in the Stowe Sentry, just in the Beacon Journal and the Record Courier.
It's on the website.
Then it's always on our website.
What's your website again?
It's AMATS planning.org.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And all the minutes and everything are there.
The minutes of all the meetings. We've got, actually, there's a wealth of information on the website, and if you have things you'd like to see on there, don't hesitate to email the staff, and we're always looking for ways to improve the website.
I didn't realize you actually put the audio on
there.
We have the MP3 files. Not a CIC, but we...
No, I think the CIC was...
Did we have CIC on there?
Yes, CIC was out there for a fair while.
Yes, we
okay.
Do.
We do.
We do have some other resolutions to discuss under item 6 on the agenda. Now, historically, we opened the motions to bundling these types of items. I'll read the 3 remaining items so that you can consider that if you'd like. We've got Attachment 6B, Resolution 2011-09, Fiscal Year 2012 Transportation Planning Work Program and Budget. We have Attachment 6D, Resolution 2011-11, TIP Amendment 55, and Attachment 6E, Resolutions 2011-12 and 2011-13. So we would open the floor to discussion of these remaining resolutions and or motions to take action as you see fit.
I would move to approve the bundle resolutions.
All right. All right, Ms. Kessler has made a motion and Mr. Kellman has seconded that we bundle the 3 remaining resolutions. For consideration. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of approval of resolutions 2011-09, 2011-11, resolutions 2011-12, 2011-13, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. That concludes the business under
agenda number six, item number six. So we open the floor now to agenda item number seven, other business. So I'll open it to anybody who wants to have a question, comment. Mr. Laudermill.
I don't mean to keep you guys here all night.
Sorry.
I do have a question. Some things that I've heard in our local council meetings, and I'd like to get it, I guess.
Okay.
And address it.
And your local council meeting is who?
Stowe.
Stowe, okay.
Stowe City Council. The first item being that projects, if the city is granted the money, or especially in the case of matching funds, things like that, if the city were to postpone the project, delay it, or just abandon the project, there's a feeling, or at least it's been expressed, that you're then penalized in future projects from receiving money from AMATS to do additional projects. Is that a true statement, or?
We don't have any. There's nothing in our funding policy that formally does that. Our committee members, I think, have always felt if there's a community that consistently doesn't follow through on a project that they get funding for, that I think they would view awarding funds to that community in the future a little bit more carefully. Quite honestly, Stowe has always done a great job of delivering projects with AMATS money. Stowe is actually per capita the highest recipient of AMATS money for its size. So I think it's safe to say, it's certainly in my own opinion, but I think in the opinion of the officials on the policy committee, that Stowe's usually done a great job of delivering projects. I think if a Stowe project fell through for whatever reason and was canceled, I don't think Stowe would be negatively viewed by the committee members. It's typically more a community like Norton years ago kept applying, they kept losing projects. And at some point, the committee was a lot less likely to really feel like, well, I don't know if we should fund a Norton project. It might go belly up. But that's never been the experience with Stowe.
The other question I had was, you talked about the traffic counts. And when you have a project, do you re-look at the traffic counts before you award the projects or finally approve them? And we've got a point on Hudson Drive, the study that was used in the records request I submitted, the maps and the traffic study that was done was 5 years old, didn't show the connection of Seasons Road to Hudson Drive, didn't show the Seasons Road interchange being completed, and didn't take into account the loss of business in that area in the traffic count.
This is the project to add lanes to Hudson Drive.
The widening.
Yeah, we usually, from an AMATS perspective, once the funds are awarded, we turn a lot of that over to the local community and to ODOT to get into those sort of details. I think that's a very valid point. I personally would hope that as Stowe and ODOT work with consultants to design the road, that they do go back and revisit that, because you're right, things can change. I think the Seasons Road interchange in particular, that will change traffic patterns on Hudson Drive. I can't sit here and say it's going to change the traffic enough to maybe not necessitate that widening, but it is possible, and I think that should be looked at. But typically AMATS isn't. Now, we can give Stowe the most recent traffic counts that have been put out, because maybe that project should, and that was kind of the point Mike made about the when projects go onto our transportation improvement program, even though they're funded and awarded, they go through still subsequent phases of detailed design. That project, it's possible maybe when the data is looked at, it should be, you know, two lanes with a center turn lane, or even for a lot of it should just be reconstructed. That's always possible. So, I mean, we would be glad to provide information to Stowe to help them design that project. But that usually is where the ball kind of goes more into the community's court for those design decisions.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Okay, that concludes.
Sorry.
Alex?
Just about the adjournment, before you adjourn, about the next meeting location, you kind of discussed it informally, and I know if there was a feeling of, because you do have it posted here.
Well, that's
whether we should or shouldn't.
Yeah, that's always put on there, but please watch for the announcements. The Beacon Journal and Record Courier announcements usually have the latest information, or the website. Typically, an alternative would be the Transit Center in downtown Akron, which is, if you haven't seen it, it's a beautiful facility. It certainly represents your tax dollars at work every day. So just please be cognizant that we do like to have meetings at alternative sites, and we do our best to get the word out. So please watch for that.
And I would maybe say, if you and Alex, as chair and vice chair, discuss a little bit if there's somewhere you'd like to have the next meeting other than Silver Lake, like there or somewhere else, let us know in the next month or so, and we'll look into it and we'll make it happen.
I'd like the Transit Center. I think if anybody else feels the same way, if you haven't seen it especially, we can arrange for a little tour. The Metro RTA people really like to show it off, so you can see some of the technological things that have gone into it. You might be surprised. I was. And it certainly adds a different dimension to just coming into a rectangular room. That's for sure.
Those lines, if you haven't, please put your email on that. I mean, if you haven't come here before, I can't remember if there's a spot for your email. We'll put that down. And then if there's any sort of changes, I'll email people, in advance to make sure that you don't forget.
Okay. Anybody else have anything? We move on to, hopefully, to number 8. Do we have a motion for adjournment?
So I'll move to adjourn.
Mr. Mackey?
I second.
Mr. Mackey? I'm sorry, the second?
I second.
Mr. Baker? All right. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none. All those in favor of adjournment, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none. The motion carries. Thanks very much. We hope to see all of you at the next meeting.